What's good, everybody? I'm Brian.
And I'm Ashley.
Welcome back to another episode of the Killer Point of View podcast, where horror movies and true crime are one and the same. We have our co-host Joe here with us.
Hello.
And today is a Thriller Thursday episode. So for those of you who are new to our podcast, every other Thursday, Ashley does a true crime movie Ashley does a true crime, and sometimes we pick a movie that has something to do directly with the true crime, or we just pick a thriller movie that we watched recently and kind of give a review on it. Today we're doing a non-spoiler review of the 2010 Black Swan movie, but Ashley, do you want to do the true crime first?
Yep, so we'll just dive right into that. Jewel Jean Buskin, better known as Julie, was born on October 24th, 1975 in Benton, Arkansas. She was a bright and enthusiastic dance student at the University of Oklahoma, where she had just earned a bachelor's degree in dance. She had plans to attend the University of Fayetteville to pursue a master's teaching program with the hopes of becoming a ballet teacher and one day opening her very own dance studio. Julie had just given a phenomenal performance of Swan Lake on December 13th, 1996, and little did anyone know that 21-year-old Julie would be dead just a week later. On Friday, December 20th, 1996, Julie's parents, Bud and Mary Jean, arrived to pick her up at the Dublin West Apartments in Norman, Oklahoma. This is where she had been living while she had gone to school. And they were really there to just kind of help her pack up the rest of her stuff and move her things. She was going home because she was going to go attend the other school. And upon arriving, they were told that they needed to call the police department because their daughter was missing. Around 4 a.m. that morning, Julie had taken a friend of hers to the airport. And by 5:30, a 911 call was made with reports of a woman screaming in the parking lot of the apartments. Several neighbors actually recall hearing her scream, as well as one saying they heard a man's voice saying, "Shut up and get in the car." 12 hours later, a body was found just 15 miles from the apartment complex at Lake Stanley Draper. Julie's body was found partially in the water, her hands tied behind her back with shoelaces. There was a very evident gunshot wound to the back of her head, and there were signs of a sexual assault. The police would discover the bullet to be a unique .22 caliber gun that was used to kill Julie. They also found shoe prints not matching the ones Julie was wearing, and these were from a size 9 Nike Air running shoe, which was confirmed by Nike themselves. Julie's leotard was also found nearby with semen on it. Julie's car would be discovered in another apartment complex just one block from where she went missing. The police began to interview Julie's many friends. At one point in time, they actually had all the males from her school and all of the neighbors with a criminal record voluntarily provide DNA samples hoping for a match. They tested 200 people and none of them would match what was found on the leotard. And so with this was kind of a thing where the people who were tested recall, as well as I believe I read something by a detective where it was basically like, we're voluntarily asking this of you, but like, if you don't give it to us, you are now automatically suspicious and we will get a warrant. So it was like voluntary, but you kind of had to do it. So a lot of people kind of recall
they were being forced to volunteer.
Precisely. Just kind of recall it being an uncomfortable situation. Obviously, most people want to help, but there are a lot of people who are very leery about just giving out their DNA. So I can kind of get it from both sides, I guess.
That's actually kind of not funny, but weird that you bring that up, because I was on Twitter and I came across a X-Files episode, like a recent X-Files episode from like when they not rebooted, but like when they brought the series back a few years ago. And it was an episode where they were talking about how people's DNA was being altered and some crazy shit. You know how X-Files is, but just weird that you bring that up. I literally was just looking at that a few hours ago. So
yeah, I know it's kind of the same thing with a lot of the ancestry stuff. There are people who are all for it. And then there are people who are like, no, don't touch my DNA. I don't want it floating out around there anyway, not realizing that on a daily basis, they're leaving their DNA all over things. So I don't know.
It's a little different. Go ahead, Joe.
I was just about to say the ancestry shit. I've thought about doing that, but it's like, no, dude, I know that shit's sitting in some fucking government lab right now, and they're just fucking keeping it on back burner in case they need somebody to fucking frame. It's just like, no, I'm not doing that.
To go back to what you were saying, Ashley, about, you know, people leave their DNA everywhere for whatever reason, it's not being collected like that, you know what I mean? Like the ancestry thing, like that's being collected.
I mean, I get it, but at the same time, if you wanted somebody's DNA that much, it's not hard. I mean, I don't know how many cases I've found where they will just literally follow these people around until they leave a coffee cup somewhere, or they flick a cigarette butt, and all kinds of stuff like that.
In most cases, or in most movies, you know, when you have like a detective or somebody trying to find some information about somebody, they'll just pick up their trash.
Yeah, I mean,
which is a little different, but
yeah, because no. It's like, yeah, it's probably somebody who's been in that house, but they can't pin. I mean, it works kind of the same way, and actually, that's what they did in the case of Brian Koberger. Was they went through his garbage, and this freak was out here like ziplocking his own garbage. He was sneaking his garbage into his neighbor's garbage at 4 a.m. and like. Anyways, back to this. So there was a $70,000 reward being offered at this time for any information. And then there would also be a man who came forward saying that he saw a male driving Julie's car that morning, I believe somewhere in like the 7 o'clock to 7:30 a.m. range. And he had actually followed this man for a while because he was pissed because this guy like whipped out in front of him, cut him off. He was going like 80 miles an hour down this road. And so they did have the man give a description and a composite sketch was drawn up. But with this feels dumb to me, to be honest. Like one, it was, I think semi-dark out still. Let's see. This was December at like, yeah, 7-something a.m. So it was still dark out. And like he could only see parts of his face in the rear view mirror. And so I don't know how to feel about that. But they did draw up this sketch. They released it to the media. It was all over the place. But despite this, the case remained unsolved. And 4.5 years after Julie's murder, police actually receive a letter from a female inmate. She was in a jail near there, and she says, hey, this guy, Dennis Sturmer, might be your guy. He lived nearby at the time, and he looks similar to the sketch. Now, I'm not sure, like, if this was somebody that she knew. Like I don't know if it could have been, like, an ex-boyfriend or something, or maybe she lived in the neighborhood with the guy. I don't know why she just, like, randomly threw out this guy, but either way, Dennis actually refused to give the police a DNA sample or cooperate with them at all. So they did end up getting a court order for his DNA, and it was tested, and it was not a match. So again, you know, we got how many years later, the case kind of went cold again. That is until Anthony Sanchez was arrested for raping his girlfriend. And upon getting his DNA from this assault, they were actually able to match the DNA that was on Julie's leotard. And they had quite a bit of circumstantial evidence against him, such as the fact that he lived just 1 mile from Julie at the time of the murder. And an old girlfriend, I guess, came forward with a diary entry of hers from October of 1996, stating that Anthony had bought the exact size and kind of shoe that left impressions at the scene, which is kind of a weird thing to write down, but just kind of remember that for in a minute here. And then there were two calls made, I think, fairly close to after she was dead. One was to a number, like, telling you the weather. And another one was, it was to a girl. It was one digit off from a girl's phone number that Anthony used to date. So they thought that was super suspicious and weird, and maybe he just forgot the phone number or whatever else. But then come to find out, there were actually a lot of calls made from her phone after she had died. And then another really just super random thing that came out was that Anthony and his father actually like to shoot 22 caliber guns at the walls of their duplex. I'm assuming this was in like the basement, maybe. I don't know why you would be shooting guns into just, I don't know why you would be shooting guns into walls anywhere, but despite that, they did find a bullet in this duplex that matched the one found in Julie's skull. So with this 22 caliber, I guess, I don't know a lot about guns, but basically they said something like the lands and grooves were very unique, and so it was easy to match. Mm-hmm. So with this, all of this stuff combined, the DNA and all this circumstantial evidence, it resulted in Anthony being arrested and charged with her murder. And then after the fact, they kind of came out with this story that, like, they said that Anthony was, like, out that morning trying to steal Christmas presents from cars when he spotted Julie, forced her into her car, then made her drive to the lake where he raped and killed her, and then he brought her car back and dumped it at this other apartment place. And he would be convicted of this murder in 2006 and sentenced to death. And he was on death row until September 21st, 2023, before he was pronounced dead at 10:19 a.m. He used his last words to maintain his innocence and said, quote, "I didn't kill nobody," unquote. And you would think that this is kind of where this story ends. And it's not, because there was a lot of controversy at the time that he was, like, convicted and while he was in prison, and there were tons of people kind of rooting for him to get out. He was doing his appeals and all that kind of stuff. And then all of this other stuff kind of comes out to refute a lot of what I just said. So there was actually a lab supervisor who was in charge of, like, all the evidence and different things, who was found to have been manipulating evidence and sending innocent people to prison. One man that he had recently sent to prison for a rape, I believe, was just let out because they found out that he didn't actually do it. Another person had came in after this guy, and they said that there was just evidence everywhere. It was loose, it was unsealed, it was scattered in hallways. It was just all basically compromised, because you can't just have stuff like that floating around, you know, which leads me to believe, could there have been possible contamination between whatever was taken from Anthony when he had raped his girlfriend and possibly onto these clothing, the clothing from Julie. It also would come out that Anthony actually wears a size 11.5 wide in shoes, which is quite a big difference from a size 9, especially the wide aspect. And I don't know that if your feet are that big, you would be able to scrunch them into a smaller shoe.
It wouldn't be comfortable. That's for damn sure.
Yeah. And then I go back to the fact that, like, his ex-girlfriend, like, wrote down, I don't know, that seems like a weird, very random thing to write down and then come forward with it.
What did she write down?
She wrote down, like, in a diary entry that Anthony had bought these size 9 Nike shoes, like the exact type of shoe. Huh. And even further than this, and it's seen in the evidence photo that the wind had actually blown the sand across the prints, making them virtually impossible to examine. So there's that. And then a lot of people have said that, you know, Anthony could have assaulted her, but there's no proof showing that he actually killed her. They never found the actual murder weapon, things like that. Crime scene photos actually also showed cowboy boots, and somebody who was known to wear cowboy boots a lot was actually his father, Glenn. And Glenn made a lot of really weird and suspicious comments. He was very paranoid about the police coming for him. His girlfriend, Charlotte, recalls that Glenn was violent, abusive, and sadistically raped her repeatedly. He would talk about Julie often, just like randomly bring her up, calling her the ballerina girl and that buskin bitch. And he even, you know, said things like, "I should have done a better job at it." And he talked about, you know, how Anthony would be fine in prison, but he was never somebody who could last in prison. And so there's just a lot that makes you really question all of the evidence. I mean, it goes deeper than what I've just said. There was a lot of stuff, but
do it say what size shoe he wore?
It does not. And I also read, I couldn't find anything disputing this, but they never took his DNA. And one thing that I was trying to find, which is, I could not find an answer because I just don't know enough about this, was how close a semen sample from my father and a semen sample from my son would be DNA wise. So like with that aspect of things, I really don't know with that. But I mean, and again, we go back to it. It could have possibly been contaminated in this shit show, in this shady ass, lab supervisor who, you know, was contaminating things. So, he did have some final thoughts the day before her death. People kind of described him as very resigned at this point. Like he knew it was coming. There was really nothing he could do at this point. And he was, they described him as very calm. But he did say, quote, "What happened to their daughter was a tragedy. It should have never happened. And if this is what they need to feel closure, then I hope it helps. I didn't kill Julie Buskin." And that is one of the last things that he said. That is like the last big statement that he made. And so there's just a lot of debate on whether or not an innocent man was put to death. And if he was innocent, then who really killed Julie? And that's about all I have on that.
And how long was he in jail for again?
From 2006 until 2023 when he was executed. So he actually had a couple daughters. I guess he was getting conjugal visits because I think he had like three daughters. I think he even had a grandchild or two. And he actually said that he didn't want to see them, you know, in his kind of final days, or didn't want them to come to obviously the execution because he didn't want them to remember him that way. So
right.
It's just, I mean, if he didn't do it, it's a very fucked up and sad situation because there's no justice for Julie if that's the case. And then we have another innocent person who is possibly dead. So, or is dead, possibly innocent. I mean,
what do you think based on everything that you found out?
I mean, I think if I would have known all of that other stuff, the contamination wise, and the huge difference in shoe size, the possible other suspect, I don't think it would have been enough for me on a jury to sit there and be like, yeah, he did it. Let's put him to death.
Yeah.
So, and it's also another thing was he was Mexican and he was also part of some Native American tribe that is escaping my brain at the moment. And he had a fully Caucasian jury. And that was another thing that they brought up to where, you know, there could have been some bias in there and not worked out in his favor. So.
Hmm. Was that all you have for it?
Yep.
Yeah, see, that like that always, I don't know, that always, I don't want to say scare me, but make me feel uneasy, like innocent people going to jail, and then especially being killed. Obviously, we don't know because we weren't there, but just knowing that, you know, there's a chance that an innocent person was put to death is kind of
right
uneasy. Joe, you got any thoughts on that?
No, that's a hell of a story, though. I'd never heard that one.
Neither have I.
No. Ashley finds the good stories. I mean, shit, that's a good one.
Well, let's get into today's non-spoiler review of the 2010 psychological thriller Black Swan. The reason why it's a non-spoiler is because we will do a full spoiler review of this film later on at some point. Just because I think there's a lot of stuff to dive into with this film. It's a lot of, it's to me, it's one of those films where you can watch it and look, and every time you watch it, you can look at a different point of view and watch it from that point of view and kind of come up with a different, you know, just opinion about the film, I think. So this film came out 2010, December of 2010. It had a budget of $13 million, and worldwide it grossed $329 million. So it was really profitable. Very, very profitable. which I didn't know it made that much fucking money. That's insane for this type of film, I think. Mm-hmm. Especially with the budget that it had. It was directed by, why is his name escaping me? Darren Aronofsky. I'm not good at pronouncing names. It stars Natalie Portman, who has been in a lot of fucking movies. She was in the Star Wars prequels. She was in, she's been in some Marvel films, the Thor film. She was in V for Vendetta. Damn, what's that one movie I just posted? The sci-fi, I think it's called Annihilation or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, she's been in a lot of shit, a lot of good shit also. She was in a film that I'm gonna get to after I name the next person. I'll come back to that. But I really like Natalie Portman. I didn't know that she went to Harvard. I think she got some degrees. Like, she's supposed to be really, really fucking smart based on the degree she got and stuff like that. I never knew that about her. No, I didn't mean to do that just now. God damn it. Hold on. It also, the Black Swan movie also stars Mila Kunis, who has been in a lot of shit also. That 70s show. She was in that one ass fest of a fucking movie with Channing Tatum, Jupiter Ascending. That movie was bad.
I don't know what that is.
That movie was horrible. She was in Bad Moms. I remember when we went to go see that. she's been in a lot of stuff also. A lot of TV shows. She's done a lot of, don't she do the voice of Meg and
Family Guy.
Yeah. she's done a lot of stuff also. Vincent Cassell, I think that's how you say his name.
I believe so, yeah.
I know him mostly from Ocean's 12 and 13, but I do know that he was in one of the Jason Bourne movies. He also did some voice work for Shrek, I believe, also.
Also in a movie called Derailed with
Jennifer Aniston. Yeah, I forgot about that one. Yeah. Winona Ryder is also in this film. If you're listening to a horror movie podcast, you probably should know who Winona Ryder is, I would assume. Just because she's been in quite a few horror classics, Beetlejuice being one, Edward Scissorhands, Stranger Things, of course, probably her biggest thing right now. She was in the newer Star Trek movies, or the first one anyway. Who was the mother? Barbara Hershey? She played Natalie Portman's mother in Black Swan. She was in Insidious. Like, that's the most recent thing I remember her being in. She was in a movie Fall Down with Michael Douglas, which is a good fucking movie if you haven't seen it. She's been in a lot of stuff also. But that's the main cast. You know, you have some other people in there also. So everyone has seen this film before, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep, this would be my second time.
Okay. Just like a quick review, not even review, but like opinion about the film. How did you feel about it, Ashley?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, just the acting from Natalie alone was incredible. I think Mila Kunis did a really good job too. Obviously, I don't even know what to call him, ballet director guy or whatever. It was done very, very well. And I mean, I kind of forgot to look into it, but I don't know if she actually did all of the dancing in this.
Not all of it.
But even what she did do, I mean, I don't know that she's a ballerina in real life, so she did a great job with that as well. Because, I mean, if anyone has, like, seriously watched ballet or anything like that, it is so, like, precise, and you have to have, you know, incredible balance and strength and stuff, so.
She actually, like, before the film was even confirmed that it was being made, she actually started training for mm-hmm. the role. Mm-hmm. And out of her own pocket, she took classes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think she started a year before the film started.
Which even then, like, ballet, a lot of ballerinas, like, you know, big name ballerinas have been doing ballet since they were small children, years and years and years and years of ballet. So
I think I read that Mila Kunis had did ballet when she was a little girl. Mm-hmm. And that was actually one of the reasons why Natalie Portman had suggested her for her role.
Oh, okay.
Because they were friends before this film. Mm-hmm. So they knew each other, and that was one of the reasons why she had suggested her. And see, that's what people don't understand about not even just, you know, Hollywood, but in business anywhere, really. It's not really about what you know, but who you know. Mm-hmm. You know, but knowing some shit will help also, obviously.
Right.
But Joe, what's your opinion about the film kind of overall?
To my recollection, the first time that I did watch it, I mean, it was obviously around the time it came out. I didn't entirely fully grasp the hidden meaning behind the movie, but having watched it the second time, watched a couple of YouTubers review it, and now that I have a better understanding of the story and everything, it's definitely a damn good movie, in my opinion. You said it was labeled a psychological horror movie?
So that is one of the questions that I did want to ask y'all is, you know, is this film a horror film? Because, I mean, it depends on where you look. So, you know, you look on IMDb, it says psychological drama, psychological thriller, drama thriller. It doesn't say horror, but I have seen some people call this a horror film, you know, especially, you know, not to dive in any spoilers, but there are some body horror elements to it. It definitely has the tone of a horror film, like suspense anyway. And, you know, I say all the time that thriller movies are just cousins to horror films. Like, they're related, you know. So it's, I don't know. What would you classify the movie as, Joe?
I kind of like the label of psychological thriller. Because, I mean, when I first looked up this movie, I have it labeled, it's labeled as a, when you like Google it, it's labeled as horror/mystery. And I'm kind of like, mystery, I really don't understand. And horror, I mean, yeah, I'm on the fence of that, but psychological thriller makes a little bit more sense. I mean, when you understand the theme and the meaning behind the story and everything, I mean, that's more of a fitting, I think, label for it.
Yeah, mystery doesn't make sense at all.
I don't understand why it does.
But the thing is, because I was thinking about this question, and, you know, I started thinking about some other films that's labeled horror movies, like Silence of the Lamb is labeled a horror film. And I mean, that could really just be a psychological thriller also. It's just it depends on how you look at it. Ashley, what do you think?
I would also stick with psychological thriller. I don't think that it really hits the mark on being horror. I just can't. I can't see that. So I definitely a lot of psychological aspects, but I would keep it as a thriller.
So I have a definition of horror because, I mean, realistically, there are a lot of different definitions for a lot of different words. So it depends on what you want to go by. But this says a film representing disturbing and dark subject matter, seeking to elicit responses of fear, terror, disgust, shock, suspense, and of course, horror from their viewers. So based on that definition, I can see how this would be a horror film, in my opinion. But again, you know, I kind of do lean more towards psychological thriller. But I don't think you're wrong either way. Just my opinion. But because, you know, some people do see it as a horror film, this was the... Damn, I'm trying to remember. This was the fifth horror film that won an Oscar. That won a category in the Oscars, I believe. Natalie Portman won an Oscar for this. Mm-hmm. I know Silence of the Lambs won an Oscar for Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster. I believe The Exorcist won an Oscar for something. Rosemary's Baby, I believe, won an Oscar.
The original Exorcist?
Yes. Why you make that face?
I mean, that's back when they was doing cocaine regularly, so I get it.
What are you talking about?
What about that movie is Oscar worthy?
You
fucking very disturbing.
You thinking about it today? You're not looking at it about like the time period it came out in. That movie freaked a lot of fucking people. I mean, I wasn't there, obviously, but I've seen a lot of different people who went to see that movie, you know, in theaters, and they just talked about how the theater was scared as shit, and like it was very. I mean, that movie is iconic, especially in horror movie. The horror movie genre is iconic, but you don't look at stuff that way.
As somebody who is legitimately terrified by paranormal things, that movie is a joke. Like,
that's because you looking
got this
at the
little girl's fucking hair spinning around or head spinning around. She got fucking slime coming out her mouth like fucking Nickelodeon was there. Like, that's not scary.
That's because you looking at it compared to how movies are today. Because of how filming and how everything has changed today. And CGI and shit like that.
We'll go with that. That's fine. We'll go with that.
It's okay. But yeah, I think if you want to call it a horror film, you know, I wouldn't argue against you. Joe, what are your thoughts on the meaning of the film? Like, what do you think the underlying meaning was of this film?
I wouldn't call this a spoiler, but the story of Swan Lake, which we kind of get a paraphrasing here, we get a description of it in the movie, but you know, it's described as an innocent virginal white swan who longs for freedom. Mm-hmm. However, only true love can break the spell, and the story goes on telling that this nearly happens when a young prince enters her life until her lustful twin, the black swan, tricks and seduces him. Devastated by this, the white swan jumps off a cliff, killing herself, and in death finds her freedom. I mean, the movie, I think, is overall a mirror image of that story. And we watch it kind of play out with these characters. I would also have to say it can have two different meanings because I watched recently a review on it. Shout out to a YouTuber by the name of the YouTube channel Lessons from the Screenplay. which did like a side-by-side comparison of Whiplash, another damn good movie, and Black Swan.
Hold on, Joe. Yesterday, after we watched this film, I literally told Ashley about that fucking movie. I was trying to get her to watch it, but she don't want to watch it because, one, she don't like Miles Teller, and two, she said she don't like drums. And I was trying to explain to her that the movie isn't all about drums.
Okay, everything that comes up, it said drum or drummer like seven times in the description. All the photos that comes up is of him playing the drums. I watch Miles Teller play the drums for an hour and 47 minutes. I'm not watching that movie, period, end of story. Back to Joe.
All right. So anyway, but a damn good movie. But the YouTuber Lessons from the Screenplay, they did like a side by side comparison of Whiplash and Black Swan, and how they the movies overall have the same kind of meaning. It's about, you know, the obsessed performer, the suffering artist, so to speak. And so I guess you could take it two different ways. You know, the Black Swan is either about the story Swan Lake, only it's told in a different form, or it's about, you know, the suffering artist. You know, each character, you know, the character wants to be the best, and so the protagonist is presented a challenge by her mentor, and she's trying to basically break out of her childlike shell, as we see in the movie, and become, you know, who she has to become in order to become the Black Swan. So, I mean, it can have different meanings, I guess, to depending on who watches it, but I mean, those are the two meanings I take from the movie. So, you know, the suffering artist who wants greatness, and obviously the story of Swan Lake.
Okay. Ashley?
For me, just at like a very base level, it's, you know, striving for perfection will be the death of you. I mean, we watched her. She was trying to, I mean, even the relationship with her mom, like, she just, everything had to be perfect all the time. We see the director guy, he tells her, like, he's like, you're always so precise. Everything is always the way it should be, but you never let loose. You never just kind of go with the flow type of thing. And so I think for me, that was kind of really the biggest thing I took away from it.
I would agree. That perfection is one of the underlying meanings of the film. Because like you said, you know, he was, this isn't a spoiler, but I mean, you kind of just said it, you know, there was a moment where she was dancing and he said that if he was just looking for the white swan, then she would be perfect because she did everything she was supposed to do. But when it came to the black swan, she didn't express enough emotion, you know, like you said, she didn't let loose, you know, she kind of did everything from a, like everything was like tactical, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. If I can add on to that, everything was basically when she did White Swan, she was very disciplined.
Yes. Yes.
Whereas Lily, Mila Kunis's character, brought passion into the dancing, which is what is the Black Swan. The Black Swan is like a seducer. So,
which brings me to my second meaning that the film could be is it could be about control, because again, I don't really think this is a spoiler, but her mother was controlling in a way, her dance director, very controlling, although you could argue that that is his job to do that. You could argue that. And Nina herself, she was controlled and disciplined to do everything the right way, but she didn't lose control in order to be the Black Swan, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Also, the story of the, you know, Swan Lake, like you were saying, Joe, I believe that, you know, because we kind of see the, especially if you pay attention to the colors of the film, you know, for half of the film, she's wearing, you know, bright colors or white or stuff like that. And as the movie, you know, progresses, she starts to wear dark colors. So I think that's, you know, kind of a symbolism for, you know, light versus dark or good versus evil. And So it's a lot of different ways, a lot of different meanings you could, you know, kind of walk away with after watching this film. So some movie trivia we can get into, unless somebody got something else to say.
Nope.
Before I get into that.
Nope.
So I kind of already mentioned that Natalie Portman had, you know, kind of started training a year before, you know, she started filming the film. She actually injured herself quite a bit, so much so that they came up with a nickname for her because she, I guess she messed up her foot quite often, but it was called Portman Toe, I think, because she... There's even a scene in the film where she kind of shows her foot after she kind of fucked herself up.
Yeah.
Which isn't a spoiler, I promise. I kind of already mentioned that Mila Kunis had something to do with, Natalie Portman had something to do with Mila Kunis being in the film. She actually just did a fucking Zoom call and she just talked to the director. She didn't even really, you know, do like a rehearsal or anything like that. Also, and this is just me remembering that time period. This film came out in 2010. Natalie Portman was in a film called, Ashley, what's the movie? No Strings Attached.
Yeah, that one.
With Ashton Kutcher, that came out in 2011, which was basically about, you know, sleeping with your friend and not really being in a relationship or whatever. Mila Kunis also was in a film that same year with Justin Timberlake called Friends with Benefits. And both films are damn near the same fucking thing. I thought that was very weird.
Yeah, they really are very similar. Like if you were to sit there and watch them back to back, they're like the same fucking movie.
It really is. And it's kind of weird because in this film, Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis, they're kind of made to be the same person. Two different sides of the same coin, I'll say that.
Yeah.
I would say that. And speaking of that, the director, because, you know, on set, you know, the directors sometimes do certain things to get certain emotions out of, you know, the actors or actresses or whatever. He would message, you know, Mila Kunis and say how good of a job that Natalie Portman is doing or vice versa to try to build some type of tension between the two. But they were friends before the movie, so they would just text each other and say congratulations, and like there was no bad blood at all. So I thought that was funny. You know, they try to play mind tricks with you, but you know, Hollywood really isn't that big of a place. I promise. So, I mentioned the Oscar wins and stuff like that, which is crazy. I feel like there's definitely some horror films that should have won some type of Oscar, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
I'd have to really think on that one.
So one of the dancers that Nina danced with, I think he was the White Swan dancer, I guess. Because she danced with, you know, the Black Swan and then the other guy she was dancing with, right?
Yeah, the prince, I think, is, I guess, who he would be.
That would eventually become her husband. That's when Yeah.
Oh, no shit.
That's when they met on this set and eventually became married. They're divorced now, I believe, but...
And they got divorced this year. Shit.
Yeah. Again, Hollywood is a very small place. Natalie Portman lost 20 pounds to look more like a ballerina. If you've known about Natalie Portman or seen her in some of, you know, movies before this, it don't look like she needed to lose weight. But I know ballerinas do
That's another thing I think that goes along with there are an extensive amount of eating disorders inside of being a ballerina, because you really do have to have kind of just this very small petite frame, and like, you know,
I think this isn't a spoiler, but in the film, Nina was eating a grapefruit and a boiled egg, which I guess was kind of a nod to what Darren Aronofsky did in Requiem for a Dream, I believe. I haven't seen that movie in quite some time, but I believe a character did the same thing in that film, if I'm not mistaken, which he also did, I believe. Because Ashley, you had asked if she did all of the dancing. I think she did about 80-85% of the mm-hmm. of the dancing. We talked about how the film had a budget of $13 million. The director wanted like 25 to 30 million, but they only gave him 13. And when they were on set, Natalie Portman had a trailer, and she said, you know, if you guys need to take my trailer away to have more money for stuff, you can do that. And, you know, they did do that. That's really all I have. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we can get into, I think, when we do it on the horror side of our podcast. Because, like I said, there's a lot of different stuff in this film. I will say that Blake Lively and Ava Green auditioned for the role of Lily, which would have been... I like that they went with Mila Kunis' character, because I don't think I could see that.
I think that Blake Lively is, like, too tall. And not even, like... I don't want to say big, because that's going to come out wrong. She's not big whatsoever, but I think just her body frame is too...
I think she is big, especially like, compared to Natalie Portman.
Yeah, I think she's too tall, and I don't even know who the other girl is, so I don't really know.
Eva Green, she was in Penny Dreadful. She was in what?
Casino Royale.
Yeah, James Bond.
All things I haven't watched.
So. She was in... She was in a lot of stuff. But yeah, I think she has, Ava Green has, those are two completely different looks, by the way. Like, if you look her up and look Blake Lively up, they look completely different. Ava Green definitely has the look of the character that Lily is, but I think personality wise, I think Mila Kunis was the best choice, because, and I'm not saying that's her in real life, but I've seen a lot of different interviews and stuff like that. You know, she has a lot of those characteristics, you know?
Yeah. It's almost as if in this movie, she really wasn't having to act that much. She was just having to kind of be herself and just read the script.
Basically, that's kind of how I thought about it also. Let's move into ratings. Joe, what would you rate the film? On a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah, 1 to 10. Well, like I said, I want to call it a psychological thriller. I don't agree with... I'm really, like I said, I'm really on the fence of giving it a horror rating. But psychological thriller perspective, I think the acting was phenomenal. I think the commitment from the actors, you know, having to endure learning those moves and everything was... And, you know, having to lose that weight. I mean, it was... They went through a lot of shit to really make this movie what it was. I think the story is well put together. It's well told. The music's good. I would give it... I'm going to give it an 8.5.
Okay. Ashley?
I think I would give it a 9 out of 10. I mean, there's really not a whole lot that I can... find wrong with it, but I think a 9.
I would give it an 8.5 out of 10. It's a really good movie. not something could watch, you know, all the time or anything like that, but it's definitely something I'll watch again. Like, this might be my third or fourth time watching the film. Has a great cast, great acting, obviously, because Natalie Portman won Oscar for it. Yeah, I give it a 8.5 out of 10. Definitely recommend watching it if you haven't seen it.
Definitely, yeah.
What do we have next? Our next episode, which will be horror movie, is the Strangers franchise. We are doing a deep dive into Strangers 1, 2, and the new one that will be out. So if you guys get a chance to go see it that weekend, be sure to check out our podcast episode, because we will be doing a full spoiler review of the entire Strangers franchise. Looking forward to that. Especially because the fucking trailer keep popping up every 3 minutes on every YouTube video I watch. Literally every YouTube video I watch, that trailer pops up. So I want to know what the marketing budget was, because they spent a lot, it seemed like. But yes, that's our next film. I don't think we have our next true crime planned.
I have not picked a case yet. I have a hard time picking.
I know we talked about doing the Green River.
Yeah, but killing. With that, I almost feel like it could just be the true crime alone, which I know is boring for you because you don't love it, but it's just, I almost feel like it's something that would...
I said we could do like a two-part.
To be, yeah, split into two parts, and like, it's a lot, so.
Yeah, we could do that. Yeah, I don't have anything else. Just remember that there is a thin line between horror movies and true crime. Good night.